have a situation where there is lots of surveillance, lots of monitoring. And if the person's working at a keyboard, for example, most of the time, there can be constant monitoring, constant surveillance of every single thing that this person does. Now, in that situation, the employer can be as close as it's possible to be to 100% certain that the work is going to be done, you know, unless the person drops dead or something. But there's no room for trust in that situation. There's no need for trust. There's no scope for trust. It's a bit like saying that you trust somebody in a high security prison. I mean, there's no point. There's no need. You're not even able to, because there's nothing they can do. And I think this is a fatal flaw in a purely cognitive account, that the stronger the justification, the less room there is for trust. Now, I'm not going to develop that anymore, but perhaps it's something we can talk about later. I want to just quickly look at the relationship between trust and freedom, or free will, if you like. If A trusts B, then, well, it would be nice if B was a free agent, but I think at least we have to say that A believes that B is a free agent. Right? There's not much point in trusting somebody if I don't believe that they are free to do otherwise than they're going to do anyway. And A would normally believe that B was free to deceive or to break promises or something like that. Okay, so there is a fairly clear relationship, I think, between trust and freedom. Now, the way I'm spelling out trust here, it should be fairly obvious that in general, I'm ruling out trusting machines or trusting the internet or something. Now, I think there's a sense in which we can talk about trusting machines, trusting aeroplanes, trusting computers, trusting all sorts of things. But that's not really a very rich concept of trust. That's basically just having confidence in them, having or relying on them and so on. But I'll spell out a bit more fully in a minute what I mean by the richer concept. Now, there's one thing that perhaps I should say, and that is that it's when I said talking about some of this stuff elsewhere once and said that Mike views on my account of trust rules out trusting in machines because of this freedom issue. Somebody pointed out that agents, intelligent agents, are getting very close to having what at least looks like the freedom to do things and so on. And so if somebody can give a good account of a machine being free, well, I'm happy to say we can trust it. But that's not a major point I don't want to talk about. Okay, so non-cognitive trust typically is spelled out in terms of something like this: trustful attitudes, effects, emotions, or motivational structures. So if A trusts B, we could say that A has some particular attitude towards B, or A takes a particular stance toward B. Now, if you take a purely non-cognitive view of trust, this is what trust would be. It wouldn't have any cognitive element at all. I don't think that's quite plausible. I think there has to be some cognitive element in it. And the way I want to spell out trust is in terms of seeing as, which probably dates me a bit. but I think there's something useful here in order to bring sort of a number of aspects of trust together. So the account that I want to use today is that A sees B as someone who typically will do as he or she says, who is reliable, who will act with interests of A in mind, who has some good look toward A, etc. We can fill in more details here, perhaps change some of these, but typically I want to say that if A trusts B, then B, A sees B in this sort of way. And later on when I'm talking about this, I'll shortcut it by saying that A sees B as somebody who's trustworthy. That might sound a bit like begging the question or circular, but I spell out trustworthy then in terms something like this. Now this clearly dates me, but I think that there are some aspects of a Kuhnian paradigm in at least one of its supposedly 23 senses or whatever, that brings together some important facts. If we look at trust as something like this, there's clearly some cognitive element. There's clearly, I mean, because we have certain beliefs, there are non-cognitive elements. There's an element of commitment, and so on. Now, perhaps if I push this analogy too hard, I might get into trouble, but I think at least at one level, there is something there. Now, just quickly, I want to say something about when it's reasonable to trust. If we're looking at a cognitive account of trust, it's reasonable to trust if the benefits of trusting outweigh the risks involved in trusting. Because remember, when we trust, and again, almost everybody agrees on this, we make ourselves vulnerable to some extent. We might be let down. So there have to be some ways of having some idea of when it's reasonable to trust, because sometimes it obviously isn't. Sometimes it's just silly. Now, on the account I'm giving, again, you can sort of see the Kuhnian or perhaps even Quinean, Wittgensteinian element in here. It's reasonable to trust, I want to argue, when A's seeing B as trustworthy is reasonable. Sorry, A's seeing B as trustworthy is reasonable if A's seeing B in this way gives a coherent account of B's behaviour. So on this account, we don't judge every particular case when, you know, the question of trusting somebody comes up. If we see somebody in a certain way, then we will typically just trust them, other things being equal, which I think fits the facts better than a purely cognitive account. And again, I think a few cases of possibly untrustworthy behaviour don't really count against trust. We can, again, in Kuhnian terms, look on these things as anomalies. Okay, normally I can trust Joe, but periodically he might do something that seems on the surface odd. But there may well be good reasons for that. And that, I think, brings an important point in, and that is that I think that despite what is often said about trust being fragile and easily broken down, I think in fact, once trust has been built up, it turns out to be pretty robust. And there are, in fact, lots of examples of this. If somebody appears to let us down, we'll normally, if in the past they've been trustworthy and we've trusted them, normally we won't stop trusting them. We'll find other reasons for their behaviour. Right? It's a bit like, when Quine talked about the maximum, I have trouble saying this, the maximum minimum mutilation of our set of beliefs. Right? Something doesn't square with what we want, but we don't straight away toss out our favourite beliefs, we look elsewhere. But of course, I mean, if there are too many anomalies, there'll come a point when it's just no longer reasonable to trust, and then the whole process has to be built up again. Okay, trust and morality. I want to suggest that there are two ways that trust is related to morality. I don't want to argue that trust is actually a moral term or a moral concept. Well, I actually quite like to argue for it, but I don't think I can. But I think there's a fairly close relationship between trust and morality. And again, almost everybody who writes on trust acknowledges that it's important for a successful society, successful group, successful relationship. Now, in a sense, I think we could say that non-trusters are free riders. They're getting the benefit. I'm talking about people in a trusting society. Now, if you're in a trusting society, you're getting the benefits of everybody else trusting. If you don't trust, in a sense, you're letting the side down, and you could well be contributing to the breakdown of trust. So that's one point. The other one is, I think that there's a link between A trusts B and A respects B. I don't think that one's a necessary condition for the other, but I think there's a fairly close correlation. One reason I think that is that if we look at ourselves and think of how we feel if somebody who we think should trust us doesn't, right? We feel let down in a way, we feel as if the person isn't treating us in the way that they should, right? You know, if you go to a conference and your partner continually checks up on you because they don't trust what you're going to do, but you know, you've never given them any reason to be distrustful. I mean, I think we, if we're in a situation where we feel we should be trusted and we're not, we I think do feel put down in some way. So I think while it's perhaps not a tight link, I think there is some link between A trusts B and A respects B. Now, trusting is obviously a good thing in general, in that we can have better societies, better relationships and whatnot. But unfortunately, it doesn't follow from that that there is necessarily an obligation to trust. I mean, it would be a good thing if perhaps if I gave, you know, 90% of my income to help AIDS victims in Africa, it'd probably do them more good than it does me. But it doesn't seem as if I've got an obligation to go to quite that extent, of harming myself to some extent for the good of others. So just because trusting is in general a good thing, it doesn't necessarily mean that there's an obligation to trust. And I've only actually found one article so far where there is an argument that we have some sort of obligation or duty to trust, and that was by Thomas, I can't remember his other name, published in one of the volumes of the Proceedings of the Aristotelian Society about 20 years ago, I think. And his conclusion is that there's no general obligation to trust, but each case has to be looked at individually, and in some cases there may well be such an obligation. Now, I want to make a claim without arguing for it to any great extent, that in a basically trusting community, the default position should be to trust. Other things being equal, we ought to trust. Now, perhaps I should say, instead of a trusting community, perhaps in a trusting relationship, right, other things being equal, one ought to trust. If we're talking about an untrusting community or an untrusting relationship, then of course I wouldn't want to argue that that's the case. Now, perhaps we can't choose to trust quite as easily as I might be suggesting, and here I think perhaps it's worth looking at William James and the will to believe. Perhaps if we don't have an obligation to trust in certain situations, we at least perhaps have an obligation to act as if we trust. One side benefit of that, just by the way, is that where people do trust somebody else, it's more likely in lots of cases that the recipient of the trust will in fact act in a trustworthy way, or at least it's a plausible argument. Okay, so finally then I get to the trust in cyberspace. And this is sort of going over what I said before, but here I'm concerned with trust in people, or whatever it is we trust when we're in cyberspace or on the internet. I'm not at this stage talking about trusting the technology. The reason this point's worth making is that so much of the literature talks about trusting the internet, trusting various aspects of the internet, when really what is meant is security and developing security on the internet. A book came out last year that was, I think, a report by somebody set up by the US government, and the book is called Trust in Cyberspace. But as far as I can tell, there's almost nothing in it about trust, where trust is any sort of rich concept with respect to people. It's all about security. I mean, that's not in the book. I'm just saying that I don't think that that's the right way to look at trust. I'm not saying either that security isn't important. Clearly it is. It's just not the main thing that I want to talk about now. The security question in any case, or looking on trust as, or talking about trust on the internet, trust in cyberspace, really as a security issue, is that it doesn't go far enough anyway. And Helen Nissenbaum brings this out nicely in that paper of hers. But even if this internet is as secure as it's possible to get, we still have people on the internet, we still have people behaving in certain ways on the internet, and it's within that space then that this issue is still important, the issue of trust, because extra security isn't going to help that. Now, Helen Nissenbaum spells out nicely, I think, what she takes to be three likely obstacles to developing trust on the internet. The first one is missing identity, because if we are on the internet, we don't see people in the sense that we do now. I mean, okay, in a couple of years' time, perhaps we'll see them, but there'll still be a lot of other aspects of personal or sort of flesh and blood contact that's not there. Well, that's actually more a second point, I think. Missing identity, so we may not know who it is on the internet that we're interacting with. Missing personal characteristics. Often all we'll see is writing coming up on the screen, so we have to interpret that in certain ways. That might give us some clues to what the person's like, what characteristics the person's had, but then in certain situations we won't know whether they are just role-playing, game-playing, or whether they are really trying to be themselves, as it were. And the third one that she talks about is missing role definitions. We've got fairly established roles in society, and she is arguing that we don't have those yet to any great degree on the internet. And that then, because of these three things, these obstacles to trust in cyberspace, that there's a real issue about whether there can be trust in this sort of environment. Now, as I said before, I want to look at trust in three areas: email, e-commerce, and virtual communities, because I think that when it comes to trust, different things can be said about each of them. And hopefully then the areas about which I'm not speaking, something can be learned about them by analogy with one or more of these three. First of all, email, I think, is probably the least interesting from this point of view. It's undoubtedly one of the most useful parts of the internet. think the way most of us use email is just an extension of other forms of communication. We spend a lot of time emailing people we know. We spend a lot of time emailing people we don't know, but they're often known to other people that we know what their mailing address tells us that they are, at a reputable university or something. So it seems to me that in lots of cases, no issues of trust in connection with the email. With email arise, they don't arise with letters and other things. So I don't want to say any more about that. The only reason that I brought it up is that I think there's at least one area of the internet where no special issues arise. So those three obstacles that the trust that Helen Nissenbaum talks about, I don't think are really relevant in this context. Electronic commerce is more interesting, and as I said at the beginning, this is the area where there has been the most discussion about trust. I think that the UK government has set up a special task force or something looking at the issue of trust. That was set up, I think, just recently. I know the EU's been talking about trust a lot, and this is all in connection with e-commerce, trying to create the right environment for e-commerce. Now, there's also been a lot of empirical work done on internet trust in connection with e-commerce. A lot of surveys have been taken of customers or potential customers and businesses. And one of the interesting things is that there appears to be very little lack of trust that such that if you order something, your request will be met. So that's one area where there doesn't seem to be much of a lack of trust at this stage. Where there is a lack of trust is in the way that the personal information that we give to the businesses we're dealing with are concerned, and how this information is going to be used. There seems to be a big lack of trust amongst customers or potential customers in e-commerce of what use is going to be made of this personal information. So e-businesses aren't trusted with respect to the use of the information, of this personal information. Now, just looking at, going back to the question of whether trust on the internet is possible, obviously in connection with e-commerce, there's a level at which it is possible because there is a lot of trust there already with respect to certain activities. The interesting question, I guess, is why there's this lack of trust with respect to the personal information that people don't like sending. Now, I think one of them fits in well probably with one of Nissenbaum's, or her third obstacle. I don't know whether Helen would actually like constantly being connected with obstacles. But her third one was that there are missing role definitions in cyberspace. And I think that this is probably one, or at least a changed role. We're used to going into a shop, and at least when we paid cash, there was often no record of what we bought, or nothing that was linked with our name anyway. When we shop electronically, of course, everything is there. And there's probably lots of personal information that was requested or at least gathered in various ways. But this is to some extent a new role for shopkeepers, one that we are not quite comfortable with yet. And in addition, this lack of trust could be associated with the fact that there's clearly profit in selling information, and also that there is a history of use or misuse this information. Okay, so the lack of trust then seems to arise in electronic commerce, not so much because people might be worried that their orders won't be met or that their credit they don't trust what will happen to their first of information. Now, I'm basing this on survey results that I've read, so it's possible that it's all wrong. But there does seem to be a lot of agreement between the surveys. Okay then, virtual communities, and this is where it starts to get more interesting, and I'm talking about things like Moos and Muds and chat groups and so on. And they seem to be, and I'll qualify this shortly, they seem to be in lots of ways quite different from email and quite different from e-commerce, because there in some cases at least might be no contact sort of in the real world between the people in these virtual communities. With email, I email Terry, it's just one extra way that we can communicate. In e-commerce, if I send off my credit card number, there's some contact with the real world because I hopefully will get a book or something and my bank account goes down. So there's some correspondence there between what's happening in cyberspace and what's happening in the world. But at least in some virtual communities, there appears to be nothing but that virtual community. And we had an example yesterday in one of the papers about an example of a kids group, chat group in Germany, where this seemed to be a case. Now, if we're looking at this sort of community, if this sort of community is to be successful, presumably there should be a level of trust the same as there is in any other community. But these obstacles that Helen Nissenbaum talked about now seem much more relevant. There is a missing identity, and we mightn't know anything about the person because we can't be sure that they're actually using their real name. We don't know anything about their personal characteristics, and we can't even glean anything from what they write because we don't know whether they are just role playing or whatever. The missing role definitions I'm not quite so sure about, but I think the first two here look on the surface anyway pretty strong. So perhaps then the notion of trust just doesn't make sense in these sorts of virtual communities. But unfortunately, the situation isn't quite so simple, because a question arises that in that sort of virtual community, who trusts what? Now, it sounds like a silly question, but if you read the literature, it turns out to be, unfortunately, not silly. Are we trusting the person who is creating the whatever it is in this virtual world, the digital persona? Or are we trusting the digital persona itself? Now, I agree that doesn't sound particularly sensible, but I'll just illustrate what I'm trying to get at with a couple of well-known examples, which were both reported widely in the literature in the middle 90s. The first one was a case of virtual rape in a Moo. And if we're talking about the people, the flesh and blood people being the important things rather than the digital persona, the notion of virtual rape doesn't really make a lot of sense. It only really makes sense if the important thing is the digital persona rather than the person. I think perhaps an even better case is the case of the man who posed as a disabled female neurophysiologist and kept up that pose for quite some time, over a year I think, might have even been longer. And apparently helped a lot of women who were having various problems on the way because they thought it was a disabled woman like they were. And but then he kept up this pose for too long and was eventually exposed. Now, the interesting thing there is that what one might expect is that the women who were deceived would feel deceived and cheated and be angry, but what seems to be the case is that they the more common reaction was something like mourning. Right? They were sad that this character, in fact, wasn't real, that it was something like a death. Now, you can't make sense of that either if we're talking about, or unless we put a lot of weight on the digital persona. So there do seem to be at least some virtual communities where that's the case. Now that sort of has an interesting effect or consequence for these obstacles to trust that we've been looking at. If in these communities there's basically nothing more than the digital persona, that's the only important, really important thing, then what you see is what you get. There's nothing else to worry about, in effect. It's not clear then that trust makes sense. I'm not 100% sure what to say about that. But it seems that these obstacles that we talked about just don't apply. There are no missing identities because the identity is just what you see. Okay, there are no missing personal characteristics because the personal characteristics are just what you see. Probably no missing role definitions because the role is just what these digital personas fulfill in this particular virtual world. But I think what we need to do is isolate various types of virtual community. Clearly not all are like that, others fulfill other needs, and people often use them to get support for various sorts of problems they have, but in those cases then there's clearly contact outside the virtual community as well, or at least there can be. So I think even in virtual communities we have to look at trust differently. If we're looking at, say, what could be a support group for people with a certain kind of disease or something, or whether we're looking at it as a mood, perhaps, where people are just there, and the people are there, and the digital persona is all that's important. Those that exist only in cyberspace are the ones I was talking about a minute ago, and it seems that trust isn't the problem because there's no missing identity, there's nothing of this. Perhaps trust doesn't make any sense. I'm just not 100% sure. I think in these other sorts of communities that trust can be a problem because those three obstacles could be relevant at least to some extent. It might be hard to know a person's identity and their characteristics and whatnot. Now, the obligation to trust, which is what I was getting to, no matter how hard I've tried over the years to give arguments which have nice, strong conclusions, I never seem to succeed. They always seem to fizzle out into fairly feeble conclusions. So, getting back to trust and morality, I said before that trust is necessary for a well-functioning community. I'm calling that A. The relationship, B, the relationship between trust and respect is the other link. Now clearly A holds in cyberspace as well. If there's going to be a well-functioning community, there's no reason to believe we don't need trust there the same as we do in a normal community. B, I'm a bit less sure about. I'm not sure what to make of the notion of respect if we're dealing with digital persona. So I think that in some context it's fine. I mean, if I'm emailing Terry, I clearly should show him, I think I should show him respect in email, the same as I always do otherwise. It does seem to me that it's a bit weaker. I'd still want to argue that the default position, if we've got a trust, if we are partaking in a trusting community or something, a virtual community, that the default position should still be the one I argued for earlier. That is, that other things being equal, one would have trust. Okay, finally then, this isn't really a conclusion, it's a summary. I've argued that cognitive accounts of trust are inadequate, that there's a link between trust and morality. In a trusting environment, there's an obligation to trust. And the situation, I think, really isn't all that different in a lot of cyberspace contexts, although it is in some. And the obligation to trust is probably weaker